Gosh, I just love this discussion about ancient civilizations, how far back we went. We're going to come back with Michael Cream. We'll talk more. I tell you what, we'll open up the phone lines at the half of this hour and then all of next hour. Lots of you are already calling. Hold on. Hold on. I still got some things to talk with him about right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo with us. Michael, some of the ancients, do they echo some of the technology we have today? Do you see a correlation there at all?
Yes, I do. One way they echo the kinds of technology we have today are in the descriptions of the flying machines and weapons and cities that they had. Another way that they may echo it is in natural abilities that people had that allowed them to perceive things at a distance. In the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there are lists of mystic powers called siddhis, siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I-S, siddhis. And among them, we find things like the ability to see at a distance, the ability to hear at a distance, the ability to communicate telepathically by thought at a distance. A lot of our technology today appears to be our attempt to manifest these same kinds of abilities in manufactured machines rather than in natural psychic or mental powers. Now, for example, we have television where we make use of certain types of electronic machinery, or we have smartphones that allow us to communicate at vast distances. But apparently, people in ancient times had higher developed mental powers than we do today, and they were able to do many of these things without the aid of this kind of technology.
And Michael, as we get into, of course, the psychic abilities of the ancients, of course, tell me, you were investigating a specific case?
Well, one of my interests in archaeology is what I call spiritual archaeology or psychic archaeology. And, you know, many archaeologists today, they rely simply on material methods for making their discoveries. But even among modern archaeologists, there are some who have employed psychics and people with different kinds of paranormal powers. One of them was J.T. Robinson, who was a very prominent archaeologist working in South Africa at the Sterkfontein caves there. And yeah, he was responsible for many discoveries of Australopithecus, which is a type of ape man. He believed it was a human ancestor. I don't believe it was a human ancestor. I believe it was just another type of being that was coexisting with humans like us millions of years ago in South Africa. But, you know, he made very important discoveries that are mentioned in the archaeology textbooks even today. But what's not mentioned in the textbooks is that he employed a psychic to help him in his research. The psychic's name was Jeffrey Hodson. And Dr. J.T. Robinson brought him to the Sterkfontein Caves in South Africa. And he would have this man lie down in the cave in a state of trance. And then he would put a little fossil bone of Australopithecus on his forehead. And Hodson would be able to envision what the creature looked like, what it was doing millions of years ago, and things like that. So that's a modern example of spiritual or psychic archaeology. But there are cases that I was investigating in India where hundreds or even thousands of years ago, there were saintly persons who were making use of paranormal abilities to discover lost sacred places and lost sacred images And on my most recent trip to India, I was investigating one of these cases. It has to do with a place called Advaitavat, which is in West Bengal. It's like a little village there. There's a little village there, and then there's some distance from the town, there is a temple. And the temple contains, it's dedicated to an avatar named Advaita. So an avatar is a descent of the divine personality into this world. And there are many different kinds of avatars. So one of them had lived at this place, but it was later lost. He lived there about 500 years ago. But then the course of the Ganges River changed, and the place where he was living was covered by sand and floods and jungles, and it was lost. But about 300 years ago, there was a saintly person in India named Sitanath Baba, and he had a vision. And in this vision, Advaita, the avatar Advaita, appeared to him in this vision and told him to go to a certain place near the town of Shantipur in West Bengal. So he went there, and he was guided to a place in the forest by his vision. And when he dug at that place, he discovered objects that had once belonged to this avatar named Advaita. And he built a temple there about 300 years ago, which is still standing today. So I went there to talk to the priest of this temple and to see those sacred objects that had been discovered by what I call spiritual archaeology or psychic archaeology. And there are many places like this in India, throughout India, that I've been investigating because I want people to know the real history of archaeology and that archaeology can be carried out in many different ways, not just the way that modern Western scientists carry it out.
Michael, what was the case, what was the episode that got you started into this field a long time ago?
Well, you know, my whole interest in forbidden archaeology and the hidden history of the human race and human devolution was a result of my encounter with the spiritual culture of ancient India. And, you know, this came about to a large extent because I was raised in a military family. My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. And that meant a couple of things for me as I was growing up. First, it meant I was living in different parts of the United States and Hawaii and the world. And I got exposed to a lot of different cultures, a lot of different worldviews. And I learned there's more than one way to look at things. And because my father was involved in the intelligence services, I grew up among people in the intelligence services and the diplomatic service. And I could see that there is such a thing as hidden knowledge. There is such a thing as confidential knowledge. There are things going on in the world that most people don't know about. There is a kind of hidden knowledge. So as I was growing up and forming my own worldview, the one that made the most sense to me that I had encountered was the spiritual worldview of ancient India. So I became interested in that. I became a disciple of a guru from India. I became a practitioner of a kind of yoga called bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. And as part of that, I began studying the text of ancient India, especially the Puranas, which are the histories. And it was in those ancient writings that I encountered the idea of extreme human antiquity, the idea that humans have existed for millions and millions of years on this planet.
It was clearly laid out, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, in great detail, and it completely contradicted everything I'd ever learned from my teachers in high school or university. So I thought, well, what is the status of these accounts? Are they to be taken as mythological, or is there perhaps some factual evidence supporting these ideas, which are found not just in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, they're found in many of the world's ancient wisdom traditions. So that's what got me looking into the whole history of archaeology beyond the textbooks, because, as I said, I was aware there is such a thing as hidden knowledge. You can't necessarily rely on what official sources are presenting. You may have to dig a little bit deeper. So that's what I did. I dug beyond the textbooks in terms of my research. I started looking into the original scientific reports, the original documents. We see that whenever there's some investigation, people are very eager to get the original reports.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the ones that haven't been deleted or
blacked out.
So that's what I did. I dug back into the original scientific reports by archaeologists, geologists, other earth scientists. And when I did that, and in the current textbooks, you're only going to see the evidence that supports the current dominant theories, namely that humans like us first came into existence less than 200,000 years ago. But when you dig into the original scientific reports, as I'm doing now and as I have been doing for the past 20 or 30 years, you begin to find many reports of human bones, human artifacts, human footprints going much further back in time than 200,000 years. And then, of course, what that means is we need new explanations for human origins. And that's what got me into the more consciousness-related side of things, because I think any new theory of human origins is going to have to accept the fact that we're not just machines made of molecules. We are beings of pure consciousness. Nobody has ever shown how the chemicals in the brain can produce consciousness. Nobody has ever shown that. They just think it's true. It's a belief. But there is a lot of scientific evidence that suggests consciousness can exist apart from the brain, apart from the body. This evidence comes from medical studies of out-of-body experiences, psychiatric studies of past life memories, and things of that sort. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that the conscious self can exist and does exist apart from matter, that consciousness is not produced by matter. And consciousness has some very unusual characteristics, which gets you into the whole topic of psychic powers and paranormal powers and things of that sort.
Michael, did you come across ever the work of Zechariah Sitchin with what you were doing?
Yes. There are a lot of us working in the alternative archaeology or history field, the alternative science field more generally, and different researchers have different sources of inspiration. The late Zechariah Sitchin was mostly inspired by the Sumerian text from the Mideast. I'm mostly inspired by the Vedic text of India. There are other researchers who are very much inspired by the ancient Egyptian text or the Chinese text or ancient Mayan text from Central America. So I tend to look for what I have in common with these other researchers rather than the differences that I have with them, which can always be found. I found what I had in common with Zechariah Sitchin was the idea that there is intelligent life in other parts of the universe, and that there has been an interaction between life on Earth and life from these extraterrestrial sources. So, yes, I am familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin and with other researchers in the alternative science field, like Eric von Daniken and others.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, my approach in my work has not been to mention the work of other researchers, either positively or negatively, in my work, because I have always had the feeling that people can read my work, they can read the work of others, and they can make up their own mind about it. But if somebody asks me what I think about a particular researcher, I feel I owe them some kind
sure.
of response, like you've asked me.
Yeah. Well, your work, though, Michael, your work is compelling. It really is. So of everything that you've done in your career here, is there one thing that stands out as for you being, you know, this is it? Here's the shred of evidence we need to prove this.
Well, I'm always looking for more. That's
to add to
one thing. What I was mostly impressed with is not any particular piece of evidence, because you know, anyone could say, well, okay, you've got this one thing, but there's so much evidence that supports you know, the modern, you know, scientific conclusions about these things. What I found most impressive about my forbidden archaeology work was that there were so many of these cases. If you look at that original book, Forbidden Archaeology, it's 900 pages long.
Oh, that's
so
it's a huge book. I remember
about that. A few cases that could possibly be dismissed.
Michael, if I remember, I think you were on my St. Louis show when I was the Nighthawk back in 97.
That is correct.
Right?
I remember that before you came to Coast to Coast.
Exactly, exactly. You were one of the reasons the network looked at me, because they said, these are the same guests that are on our show. And everything just worked out after that. So thank you.
Well, and I'll just thank you for whatever you've been able to do to let people know about my work over the years. I really appreciate that.
We've had fun at events, conferences, this program. You do a great job.
Well, you know, I think I'm not a lone ranger in this sense. I think there's a whole community of people in the world today who are interested in exploring these alternative ideas. And I think we're all part of it, in the sense that there are listeners, there are radio and other types of media hosts who are providing platforms for communicating these ideas.
Yep.
People are spreading these ideas through social media. There are people who are dedicating themselves more or less full time to researching these things and provide. And I think it all works together.
It does. Michael, we're going to come back and continue talking with you, but let's open up the phone lines and they get a little jump on the phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take some phone calls this half hour with Michael Cremo, and then the full last hour we'll take calls as well, as we talk about his work as the forbidden archaeologist on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo with us. We'll take your calls as well as we talk about forbidden archaeology. You know, Michael, there aren't a lot of people like you out there researching this the way you do. How come?
Well, for one thing, it's not easy.
No. That's true.
And there is a price to pay for it in terms of being popular with the current authorities established in the scientific world and the education system. You know, I look at it this way. It would be nice to live in a time when the ideas that are represented by my personal convictions were the mainstream ideas. Okay, that might be nice. But sometimes I think a person has to stand by their convictions, even if they are opposed by the mainstream authorities of one's time. So I guess I'm just that kind of person.
One of a kind, Michael. One of a kind. Let's take some calls here with you. We've got Eric driving in Tennessee to get us started here. Eric, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Back when I was in college, I had a friend of mine who is now some kind of geneticist that had a strange theory about the origin of, or part of our history, where we came from, and an early advanced civilization. His theory was that we were very advanced, incredibly intelligent, and were spreading throughout the universe as quickly as we could, taking whatever we felt like taking. I guess we had a bit of malevolence in us, and somehow we were stopped. And usually you don't think of us being the bad guy, but we were put here to you know, kind of save the rest of the universe. And his theory is we were limited intelligence intellectually, limited physically, and limited with our lifespan, but our virility was increased so we don't die out. And he's basically thought, you know, his opinion was every time that we reach or attain a level of technology that we could escape the planet and maybe threaten others again like we had before, that were somebody reaps upon us a cataclysm that stops us in our tracks and knocks us back down to where we were originally placed.
What do you think of that, Michael?
Well, I think that's partially true. I think originally we're beings of pure consciousness, and we exist on a level of the cosmos dominated by pure consciousness, where we exist in loving harmony with all other beings of pure consciousness and with the source of all conscious beings. You could call that God if you like. But in this context, I'm speaking of the source of all conscious entities. Now, when a conscious self becomes egotistical or dominating and controlling, selfish, and trying to exploit others, then it can no longer exist in that harmonious state. So there has to be some place for it to exist. So that higher cosmic intelligence provides the material universe as a field of activity for such conscious selves. Now, there are two kinds of conscious selves on this level of reality on which we now find ourselves. There's one type that's trying to get more and more deeply involved in dominating and controlling and exploiting matter in competition with others that are trying to do the same thing. So I think that is the type of personality that your friend was talking about. But I think there's another type of conscious being in this world, and that is the conscious self who's trying to understand, I'm a being of pure consciousness. I'm not just a machine made of matter in competition with others for survival. We're all beings of pure consciousness. We should be trying to find out how we can satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible, and put most of our human energy into restoring consciousness to its original pure state. So I think the higher powers in the universe are going to deal with the two types of conscious selves differently. I think the type that you're referring to belongs to the first group, the type that is trying to dominate, control, and exploit the material resources in competition with others. and they deny the existence of the conscious self. They say we're just like robotic machines made of matter, and the only thing that really should concern us is getting the most out of the material resources as possible and doing that in competition with others. So I think the higher powers in the universe are more or less going to deal with that type of mentality in a different way than they deal with those that are trying to recognize and understand their nature as all beings of pure consciousness. I don't know if that makes sense to you. I've tried to explain it as
sure
best
does.
I can.
Michael, here we are 4.5 billion years old in terms of a planetary system, and the universe being 14 billion years old. There's got to be many civilizations that are way more advanced than we are, don't you think?
Yes, I think they've existed in the past. And according to the Vedic cosmology, there are 400,000 human-like forms of life scattered throughout the entire cosmos, existing at different levels.
Wow. Would that be just our galaxy or the entire universe?
The entire universe. Our galaxy is part of the universe. But there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the entire universe. And they exist on different levels of the cosmos, because I think the cosmos has more in common with computer gaming and things like that than with the kind of clockwork universe that used to be presented to us. I think it's a consciousness-based universe. And just like a computer game, the designers of the computer games try to build digital environments that people can act in and get certain kinds of experience out of. So I think our universe is set up like that. It's designed to deliver different kinds of experiences to conscious selves who exist at different levels of reality, some having higher capabilities than others. So I think there are extraterrestrial beings in the cosmos who have more power over things than we do.
There's no question. What do you think of the theory of there might not have been a Big Bang, that the universe was always here?
I don't think the universe was always here in its present state. I think a universe has always been here. According to the Vedic cosmology, universes are constantly being manifested and unmanifested. They come into existence at a certain point in time, and then they go into a dormant state, and then they're revived again. You know, just like we go to sleep at night and we're not active externally, and then we wake up and then we're active again, then we go to sleep and then we're dormant for a while, then we wake up again. So universes are like that. They exist in a manifest active state for some time, and then they go into a dormant state, and then they're active again for some period of time, go into a dormant state. So I think, in a sense, the universe is, because there's not just one, there's unlimited numbers of universes as far as I'm concerned, but they're involved in a cyclical process. So in a sense, you could say they're always here, but they're here in the sense that they come in and out of a manifest state.
Next up, let's go to Michelle in the state of Washington. Michelle, you're on with Michael Cremo. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I was a huge fan of your radio show and Art Bell.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Thank you.
And in the state of Washington, we have a lot of UFO, I guess, phenomenon
here.
Oh,
you sure do.
And my understanding from my father, who's Shawnee Indian, he gave me a really full introduction and education about what Native Americans believe as far as what we live today and what they believed before today, before the white man. And my understanding is a lot of the Native Americans, like the Mayans and the Hopi Indians, had contact with aliens. And he also had a biblical belief in, like, the Nephilim.
Nephilim, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
And as far as, like, the biblical beliefs and the Native American beliefs is that we do have contact with aliens in, you know, other dimensions that do visit the earth. However, as far as malevolent and benevolent interaction with the earth that we currently are living on, there's like this kind of black and white, like the malevolent are here to kind of take over the earth and take over humanity, whereas the benevolent take on Earth is to kind of move into a more harmonious and positive way of life. So there's like this battle between good and evil, and there's
sounds like the Bible.
Yeah, there's that interaction a lot in the same way that your guest was describing. There's the malevolent that's trying to take over the resources and the good in people, and the benevolent that's fighting against it. But what my father taught me was, regardless of either way, all humans here on Earth have the capacity to have that sixth sense, or, you know, that higher understanding.
Sure. Your father taught you well, Michelle. Right on, Michael. She's right on.
Yes, absolutely. You know, later on this year in June, I'm going to be a speaker on a cruise that's going up to Alaska. It's called Spiritual Cruise.
Really? That sounds like fun.
One thing I'm going to be talking about is the similarities between the Vedic cosmology of India and the cosmology of Native American Indian people, such as the Tlingit people of the American Northwest and Alaska. So I think that Michelle was really right on in bringing up these different concepts. I think the cosmologies of these ancient people share a lot. And I think, you know, even In my book, Human Devolution, I have a chapter on the cross-cultural study of cosmologies, where I look at cosmologies of about 30 different civilizations and cultures, widely separated by time and space in the world. But they have these amazing similarities. You know, the idea that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, we have a non-material source, there are benevolent and malevolent forces in the cosmos, there are higher senses, there are interactions between higher dimensional beings and terrestrial beings. These are all features of these cosmologies. And I think the reason why these cultures and civilizations have such similar ideas is that they were all in touch with the same realities. Now, because they were in different positions in time and space, their perceptions of these realities might have some slight differences, but still you can tell, you know, they're talking about the same thing. It's as if people were looking at a mountain from different directions, from the north, south, east, and west. From their descriptions of what they see, it's going to be obvious they're talking about the same mountain. But because they're looking at it from slightly different directions, their descriptions are going to also have some slight differences as well.
What do you think of the possibility of time travelers, Michael?
I personally...
Coming back.
Personally, I think time travel into the future is possible, but I've got questions about the ability of a conscious self in the present reality to be able to journey into the past. I've got an open mind about it, but I've got some doubts about it.
Many people, yeah, many scientists say the same thing, that going into the future, and they say we can go to the future, but to me it's, you know, like nanoseconds.
You can skip into the future. I think that's possible.
But everybody wants to go back into time, don't they?
I guess that would let us correct some mistakes that we may have made.
Maybe. Let's go to Doug in Vancouver, Canada, British Columbia. I'll be out there on June 6th. Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, and I hope Michael is coming with you.
Michael, I don't think you're on this trip, but you've been on many.
Well, I might be.
I was hoping we'd sit down for a beer or two. Darn it.
You know, in August, the end of August, I'm not going on the same trip that George is going on. Sometimes I am where he's going. But I think separate, like, from him, I'll be in Vancouver and Victoria, on Victoria, or was it Vancouver Island, at the end of August. And if you look on my website, mcremo.com, the schedule link, you'll see the information about those events. But I do like being at a conference or event with George, but I don't think I'm going to be with him in Vancouver.
We got to get you at some, though, Michael. They think the world of you. And Doug, with a minute left, did you have a question for Michael?
I do. I just, it was in regards to Michael saying that he had talked about the jawbone of the ancient skull that was found.
Right.
And I was thinking to myself, the age of it, is there any correlation? I'll follow up with that. But is there any correlation to the age and the size of the skulls, human skulls?
Well, in these cases, they're not talking about skulls. They're talking about the jaw fragment that was discovered recently in Ethiopia is about 2.8 million years old, and it's kind of like a fragment of a partial jaw. It's not from a complete skull.
Michael, I'll let you finish that up when we come back, and then we'll take final phone calls in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM.